Welcome.
You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. It is Sunday, February 15th, 2025, and I'll begin with the interview. Denzel Washington has finally found his purpose. It's not acting. And the interviewer, as usual, is David Marchese. So many of Denzel Washington's greatest performances, from the majestic title role in Malcolm X to the unrepentantly corrupt cop Alonzo Harris in Training Day, have been defined by a riveting sense of authority, an absolute absence of pandering or the need to be liked. There's an inner reserve deep down inside his characters that is unassailable, a little enigmatic, and that belongs to them alone. The commanding qualities that have helped Washington become a cinematic legend are also, as I learned firsthand, the same ones that make him an unusual and unusually complicated conversationalist. The first of our two discussions was done remotely. He was at a photo studio in Los Angeles as the fires were still burning there, and I was at home in New Jersey. Even putting our physical distance aside, the discussion felt, well, distant. Or let me put it this way, we never quite figured out how to connect. Our second time we talked, it was different. I met Washington in person at a spare, drafty room in a midtown Manhattan building where he was rehearsing for an upcoming Broadway appearance. He's playing the lead in a new production of Othello that goes into previews on February 24th. It co-stars Jake Gyllenhaal as Iago and is directed by the Tony Award winner Kenny Leon. I can't with any certainty really say why, but things just felt easier on the second go-round. What I do know, though, is that the entire interview experience was for me an indelible as one of his performances. And David asks, I saw that at the end of last year you were baptized and earned your minister's license. I got baptized, and I have to now take courses to obtain a license. I'm not an ordained minister. Can you tell me about the decision to go through that process at this point in your life? I went for a ride one day. I decided to get in my car and drive to Harlem. I stopped in front of the church that my mother grew up in. The door was cracked, so I went in. They were celebrating young students, members of the church. They were going to college, and I got involved in that. And one thing led to another, and weeks later, months later, I got baptized. Your father was a preacher. Yes. Do you feel like you're following a family tradition? It was prophesied in my youth that I would travel the world and preach or speak to millions of people. I used to think that I was doing that through my work. Now I'm trying to be a bit more specific, speaking about my faith. I've seen you refer to the prophecy. Can you tell that story? Well, a woman was sitting in my mother's beauty shop in 1975. The reason I was in there was I had flunked out of college. I was told to take a semester off to think about what I wanted to do. And every time I looked up, I saw this woman looking at me, and she said she was having a prophecy. She didn't say anything about me being an actor, but I have traveled the world, and I am speaking more and more. Do you think there might come a time when you move to speaking mostly through ministry and not through acting? I don't know. This is a shot in the dark. There's a book by James Baldwin called The Devil Finds Work, and in it he makes connections between the church and the theater. Does that comparison ring true for you? The universal stems from the specific, so you've got to be more specific. He says both are about people experiencing an event together and communally creating the event as it happens. There is a spirit that, for him, was similar between the church and the theater. I agree with that. The reason I ask about theater is because you're going back to the theater to do Othello. Can you tell me about the rewards for you of doing Shakespeare. I think that still gives me the greatest joy, acting on stage as opposed to acting in movies. I watched the commencement speech you gave at the University of Pennsylvania years ago, and you talked to the students about how you have to be willing to take risks. Are there ways in which doing Othello feels like a risk? In light of all that's going on in our world, all that's going on in our state, California, and our city specifically, it's just a play. I'm grateful for the opportunity, but when put in perspective, it's just a play. What has your experience been with the fires, just as a spectator, and just being amazed, the scope, the devastation, and then hearing about a lot of people in our industry who've been affected? It's unbelievable. Does it make you want to live somewhere else? You mean like run? Well, just the reality of the danger in California, it's scary. Nah, doesn't make me want to live somewhere else. Let me shift gears. I want to ask you about family. Did having children change your perspective on your work? Yeah, it changed my perspective. Like, shoot, they've got to go where to school? It costs how much? How much do clothes cost? Yeah, it changed everything. I'm always curious about actors and artists generally when they realize that their art is also a business. Does that affect how you approach the work itself? When I learned about my least favorite uncle, my Uncle Sam, that was an eye-opener. I'm like, he takes what? That's the reality of it, and a dollar is not a dollar. By the time agents, lawyer, business manager, Uncle Sam, everybody else gets finished with you, a dollar is about 38 cents. So you've got to cobble those 38 cents together to make a real dollar. But does that affect your work? If you know that something is a money job, do you go about the job any differently? You're asking me, did I ever take a job for money? No, I'm asking because I was about to answer it. Oh, okay. I've taken every job for money. There's no job I've taken where I went, you guys just keep the money. I'm just so glad to be an actor. I don't even want the money. There's got to be a difference in the calculus when you say yes to Mississippi Masala or Malcolm X as opposed to Virtuosity or Ricochet. Yeah, probably. Especially Virtuosity. I had some bills to pay. Ricochet was more like venturing down that road for the first time. The action movie road? Yeah, the action movie road, which I didn't really know. Virtuosity definitely had something to do with tuition, he laughs, I'm sure. Going back to the subject of your children, they all work in the business. Was that something that you felt you had to navigate with them? They got jobs before I knew they were in the business. John David was reading for Ballers, and I didn't even know about it. Pauletta didn't tell me. And so he got the job before I knew about it. Your wife, Pauletta, is an actress. Yes, and a singer and concert pianist. Are you familiar with the Van Cliburn competition? The piano competition? Yeah, my wife was a Van Cliburn competitor. Juilliard, North Carolina School of the Arts. I married up. What have you learned about being an artist from her? That it's an art. Acting just sort of chose me, and I got going. But she's an artist. I never looked at myself that way. I learned a lot about it, the discipline, the appreciation from her. Do you still not look at yourself as an artist? I try not to look at myself, period. I'm not much for reflection. Can I ask you about? I don't have any money. That was my next question. Go ahead. You were going to ask me about what? In the first piece you did for Esquire last year, tied to Gladiator II, you talked about your life and your career, and that was the first place, at least that I've seen, where you talked about drinking. You said there was this long period from 1999 to 2014 when you put the beverage down. You were bitter. Bitter about what? I was bitter when I put it down, or I was bitter when I picked it up. Well, in the piece you said, I was probably bitter when I picked it up, not when I put it down. But what were you bitter about? Pick something. I don't know. Any excuse will do, and no excuse is good enough. Do you have insight into what the drinking was about? We don't have that much time, brother. Is it right that you used to carry around your acceptance letter from the American Conservatory Theater? Nah, I kept a letter from my English teacher. Why was that something you kept? You just want to get all in my business because it made me feel good. I'm just trying to fish around for things that might be engaging. I'm not trying to get all up in your business, but you are all up in my business. I apologize. I don't like it, man. And he paused. I'm joking. Oh, thank God. That was a joke, gee whiz. I know how to get you now. You're easy. I'm too easy. Can I be honest with you? Yeah, go ahead. I don't know where to go conversationally with you. Maybe I should ask you a question. Sure. Why do you feel that way? The answers have been short, and often in this sort of thing, people are a little more expansive. Okay, ask me a question, and I'm going to give you an expansive answer. Okay. Not too long ago, you finished filming with Spike Lee. Yes. That was your answer. He laughs. You tricked me again, and it was your first time working with him since Inside Man almost 20 years ago. How has your relationship with him changed over time? That's a good question. Finally. It didn't feel like 20 years. It felt like we picked up where we left off. You know, I mean, Spike is Spike, meaning Spike is consistently Spike, and I love that about him. And I love working with him, and I'd work with him again. I just like the way his brain works. I'd like to ask philosophical questions about why people do what they do and the meaning of it. There's nothing wrong with that. When I've asked you those types of questions, it hasn't seemed interesting to you. And as a result, I feel like I've been flailing. What's that about? What about that? Well, here's your opportunity to get back on track with your next question. So, I'm always curious about the interplay between the life and the work. I just rewatched Flight, and in that you play an airline captain named Whip Whitaker, who is struggling with alcohol and manages to save a flight in semi-miraculous fashion. Did playing that character show you anything about your own situation? Not that I recall. First of all, I didn't drink and work, never have. And I work and then drink. Honestly, I don't even remember whether I was drinking those evenings or not. But what was the question? Did it affect? Did you learn anything about yourself from doing a role like that? I think when you're in the middle of it, you're not so self-reflective because you're still working out the character. You gain an understanding after the fact. Well, if you're thinking about it, which I probably wasn't, what kind of things do you think I should ask me? I want to know more about you. We can switch roles. I would love to do that. If you said to yourself, I wish I was better at this, what would that be? Aside from interviewing Denzel Washington, come on now, don't deflect. We're talking about you. I'm not assertive enough, and I have a problem with conflict. And because I avoid it rather than getting solved, problems linger. And that has something to do with your dad, or what? See, I should be taking lessons from you. Would you answer these types of questions if I asked you? Ask me. What do you need to work on the most? Othello. You said I can't deflect, so you don't deflect. Okay, good point. What do I need to work on the most? I was going to mention my faith, but that sounds like deflection. I don't know. I can't think of something I need to really work on. Relationships, you can always do better there. Ask me another one. Tell me the second thing that you love, not the first thing, the second thing. This is going to sound corny. Laughter. That's a great thing. Okay, this is David. Okay, your turn. The opportunity to lift others up. How have you done that? Every opportunity and every which way I can. sometimes with a dime, sometimes with a dollar, sometimes with a good word. I love seeing people do well. Last question for this time. What should I think about in preparation for when we talk again? Man goes down to the ocean and tries to fit all the knowledge of the ocean into his little brain instead of just jumping in the water and enjoying himself. Sometimes you just have to have faith in things bigger than our ability to understand them. Sometimes you have to just jump in the water and enjoy yourself and not try to figure it out. All right, David says, that is something for me to think about. Bring your bathing suit. We're jumping in the water together next time. Washington and I spoke again the following week. Thank you for giving me another run at this. How much of our conversation from last week do you remember? None. Good. At the end of our conversation, I asked if there was anything I could reflect on before we spoke, and you told me this little parable. The way I was thinking about that parable was that I felt as if in our first conversation I was too wrapped up in expectations of how the conversation was supposed to go rather than just being with you in the moment. But where did you learn that sometimes you've just got to jump in the water? Well, I've tried everything else. I was reading Matthew today, and he talks about the seed, and if you put it in rocky soil, it won't grow, and all those things. You have to have faith that it will grow. You can't even figure out how it grows or why it grows or where the sun comes from. Here's what I mean. Man tries to reduce everything down to his understanding, which is the ultimate in ego. If I don't understand it, it doesn't exist. Some people don't understand God, so some say, therefore, he doesn't exist. Or they say, I'm God, because that's what they need. Well, how's that working out? You also spoke last time about the value for you of helping people. Does acting help people? At this point, everything I'm doing is through the lens of what God thinks, not what they think. I don't know what they think. You go down that hole, you'll never come out of it. When people say, what do you want people to get from this movie, or what do you want them to get from this play, I always say, it depends on what they bring to it. There's some interesting themes in Othello of jealousy and envy and pain and death. And Kenny, the brilliant director, he's putting it in what he calls the near future. So all of those things, jealousy, envy, it takes on a whole new thing with the information age. What's your favorite line from Othello? I don't know. I've got two, David says. One is Othello's. One is Iago's. Othello's is, who can control his fate? And then my favorite line in all of Shakespeare is Iago's, I am not what I am. He said it yesterday. He's a complicated guy. He's going to be brilliant in this. Who, Jake Gyllenhaal, who's playing Iago? He's nuts. I love him. He's complicated, but he's already got a handle on it. I'm not worried about that because I don't like to learn the lines too soon. I was telling a younger actor who asked, why don't you like to learn them too soon? I said, because then I'm the voice I'm listening to delivering the cues to myself. I want to hear it from you, and that's going to affect how I say what I say. For me, that works. You say everything now is through the lens of what God thinks. How does acting fit into that? That's why you pray every day. I'm like, okay, Lord, I'm here. I think this is what you wanted me to do. Now I'm not sure why, but one can say coincidence and serendipity and all those things. I bit my tongue almost half off a few months ago. It's affecting my speech. It forces me to slow down. I have to use it. I have a line, whither will you that I go to answer this your charge? It's hard because my tongue is swollen. It has affected everything. But you've got to use it. Jump in the water and enjoy yourself instead of worrying about drowning. I've been thinking a lot about David Lynch, David says, who just died. Blue Velvet, heck of a movie, man. I loved it. I went, this guy is nuts. And David asks, One of the reasons I've been thinking about him is that about 15 or so years ago, I was really low and I was in a bookstore and I saw that David Lynch had this book, Catching the Big Fish, about creativity. In it, he says that one of the benefits of meditation is that it helps you become more you. Then I started meditating. That one sentence in one book by David Lynch changed my life. Have you ever had an experience like that, where from afar someone changed your life? The prophecy changed my life completely. Going back to Matthew, it must have been a seed planted, but I wasn't ready for it, or I didn't understand it. I was 20 then. I'm 70 now. I'm on that 50-year journey to understanding. Did an artist ever change your life? Yes, my English teacher, Bob Stone, who was in Othello with Paul Robeson. He wrote a recommendation letter for me for the American Conservatory Theater, which I still have. He basically said to them, if you don't have the ability to give this young talent what he needs, then don't accept him. I was like, wow, reverse psychology. But he was artistically, especially early on, the most important person because he had been there. He understood the game. David, this is a base question, but did you find that you cared about not getting an Oscar nomination for Gladiator 2? I was sitting there smiling, going, look at you. On the day you didn't get a nomination for an Oscar, you're working on Othello on Broadway. Are you kidding me? Oh, I'm so upset. Listen, I've been around too long. I'm getting wiser, working on talking less and learning to understand more. And that's exciting. Is there anything you want people to take away from this interview? Believe in something greater than yourself. Believe. Look at the world. What does it give you every day? Fires, death, murder, politics, dictators, division. Look at the world we've created for ourselves. That's all I'm going to say. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. Imagine this. The sublime beauty that airplanes leave behind. Contrails conjure a sense of something overwhelming and ineffable, as terrifying as it is beautiful. This is a letter of recommendation by Kate Folk. I spend most days working from home in my apartment in San Francisco's Richmond District. When the morning fog is burned off, I throw on a hoodie and go for a walk. I head up a hill to a lookout spot from which I can survey the sky. It has become a daily ritual, a way to gauge my mood and remind myself of the scale of my concerns. One recent day, I walked to my perch and watched a plane make its way west, leaving behind it a silver thread. My flight tracking app revealed this to be a Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner, traveling from Los Angeles to Tokyo. By the time it landed, its contrail still lingered in the sky above San Francisco. Some people enjoy watching clouds, but I prefer contrails, those chalky lines left in the wake of aircraft at high altitudes, where the temperature and vapor pressure are low. The plane's engines expel their hot, humid breath, which cools and condenses in the air, similar to how exhaling in cold weather creates a cloud of condensation. NASA lists three types of contrails: short-lived ones that form directly behind planes as they fly, then dissipate quickly; persistent, non-spreading trails that maintain their narrow form but can linger a long time; and persistent spreading trails that can fan out to cover a wide area. On clear days, the resulting contrails are stark and white, accentuating the sky's watery blue. At sunset, they're cast in a dreamy golden shade. To me, their beauty derives in part from their incongruity with the sky's naturally occurring features. The marks themselves are incidental, a quirk of atmospheric physics, but they sometimes seem like characters I follow in an otherwise impersonal sky. I recently took a photo of a trail following a plane flying above the Sutro Tower, rising from the city's heart. Though the aircraft was at cruising altitude, the Earth's curvature made it appear to be flying diagonally, its nose pitched to the sun. Its movement made it seem cheeky, touched by an aura of optimism. There is an uncanniness to contrails, a sense of something both familiar and alien, a cloud that seems to be imparting a message, if only we could decode it. At a residency that I attended recently in the Pacific Northwest, my fellow artists and I gathered outside the lodge before dinner to marvel at a thick, puffy band of white stretching all the way from one end of the sky to the other. The trail was so bold, assertive, against an otherwise cloudless sky that we felt darkly intrigued and stood around speculating on what type of plane might have created it. The mystery of the contrail lent it a special power that held us in its thrall, bonding us at that early moment in our friendship. While contrails are not to be confused with the chemtrail conspiracy theory, which posits that exhaust from airplanes is laced with additives used to control the population, they are nefarious in more prosaic ways. They are now thought to contribute up to 35% of planetary warming caused by aviation, second only to carbon emissions. Persistent spreading contrails are the most damaging, as these man-made clouds can blanket large swaths of sky, trapping heat in the atmosphere. Recent studies have suggested that the impact of contrails could be significantly reduced by pilots slightly altering their courses to avoid areas where contrails are likely to form, as they currently do, to avoid patches of air where turbulence is likely. It's possible that in a few years, contrails will be scarcer, relics of a less eco-conscious past, like aerosol cans and plastic foam packaging. Is it wrong to find beauty in something we know to be destructive? There's admittedly something a little perverse about being a contrail enthusiast. For me, they conjure a sense of the sublime, a confrontation with something overwhelming and ineffable, as terrifying as it is beautiful. Traditionally, the sublime refers to encounters with the natural world, such as standing at the lip of the Grand Canyon, or witnessing the devastating power of a tsunami. I had a similar feeling on the infamous Orange Day in 2020, when the skies above San Francisco and much of the West Coast were dim and orange-hued because of wildfire smoke. I walked through the eerily transformed landscape of my neighborhood, feeling a sense of negative awe. In that moment, I understood myself as a fragile mammal of tiny proportions relative to the scale of the planet and the climate crisis that threatened it. Contrails produce a similar effect for me. Sometimes when I look at one, I slip into an oceanic feeling, a sense of connectedness with the rest of the universe, as if a contrail is a tether between me and everything else. Unfortunately, everything else also includes the mass waste that we inflict upon the planet, which is all to say, I'm not always in the mood to be charmed by contrails. On certain days, the contrails are stripped of their magic, revealed as noxious clutter. I imagine shaking the sky like an etch-a-sketch, ridding it of its vaporous waste. Regardless of my mood, I can appreciate contrails as a physical record of humanity's existence on this earth. I think about this as I observe a cross-thatching of persistent contrails, scars left by planes that have departed my little slice of the sky. They are ghostly forms reminding us of the plane that recently occupied this point in space, like the speed echo left by a cartoon character as they rush out of frame. I am here, and a moment later, I'm elsewhere, but a shadow of my former self remains, for better or worse. Now I'll read Screenland. When remaking a masterpiece is worth the risk. Robert Eggers confronts the corrosive effects of power through his depiction of an unspeakable erotic bond. This is an article by Jim Shepard. I've always thought that one of the most insoluble aesthetic problems going is remaking a movie masterpiece. I certainly understand the impulse to passionately re-engage such a work, but if the definition of a masterwork is something peerless at what it sought to accomplish, how do you remake it without simply reiterating it? There's a reason no one has tried second versions of Fellini's 8½, or Coppola's The Godfather, or Polanski's Chinatown. In the case of Fellini's achievement, is someone going to produce a more harrowing portrait of the self-deluding toxicity of male narcissism? In the case of Coppola's, of the corrosive effects of power? Or in the case of Polanski's, of the hey-nothing personal malevolence of late model capitalism? Water itself, in that movie, turns out to be the commodity that's manipulated for profit. When it comes to those who have waded into that kind of deep water, some have tried the let's really shake things up solution. There's the lamentable 1962 remake of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, for instance, which not only eliminated the central figure of Césaire, the somnambulist, but also featured a Caligari who, instead of practicing diabolic hypnotism, spent his time showing the heroine offensive pictures. Other filmmakers have chosen the even more baffling route of changing almost nothing, such as Gus Van Sant's nearly shot-for-shot 1998 remake of Psycho. The number of disappointed moviegoers you risk in remaking a masterpiece from 1922 is smaller, for obvious reasons. But even so, the director, Robert Eggers, has made clear in any number of interviews his understanding that his new Nosferatu is re-engaging one of the greatest of the silent films. In 2016, when he was first attempting to remake the film, he told an interview that it felt ugly and blasphemous and egomaniacal and disgusting to take up that project so early into his career. F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, is itself a remake, an unauthorized adaptation of Dracula, Bram Stoker's compulsively readable fever dream of a novel. And Murnau and the screenwriter Henrik Galen retain much of what was arresting about the original while slipping in their own major changes. They're responsible, for example, for the now set-in-stone tradition that sunlight can destroy the vampire, a notion nowhere in Stoker's book. I likely saw Nosferatu at too impressionable an age. I was 6. PBS was showing such things, and my babysitter was simply glad I wasn't burning down the house. But I would have been flattered by it whenever I saw it. But I would have been flattened by it whenever I saw it. It was like having felt a draft from a grave. Its effects were so long-lasting that 30-something years later, I published a novel inspired by the film and its production. The whole thing wasn't so much petrifying as insidiously unsettling, and all of that started with the figure of Nosferatu himself. Max Schreck's performance is, 102 years later, still the benchmark for sinister and dignified repulsiveness. Schreck's vampire has the stillness of a figure in a bad dream or a spider on its web, and the world he inhabits is at times equally disconcerting. After our hero hutters first frightening night in Nosferatu's castle, he notices in the mirror that something has bitten his neck, and he smiles. But the most destabilizing figure might well be Hutter's wife, Ellen, our heroine, who's again and again shown to be telepathically on the monster's wavelength, even when he's thousands of miles away, so that polarities like good and evil or desire and repulsion seem to just evaporate while we watch. That last aspect alone would seem to land this story in Robert Eggers' wheelhouse. Part of the subversive energy of movies like The Witch, The Lighthouse, and The Northman derives from what feels like modern takes on historical characters in thrall to dark passions, so that the distantly historical is both granted its strangeness and animated by a scrutinizing modern sensibility. At its best, his vision both evokes and reconceives Murnau's most brilliant visual ideas. Murnau's masterful use of the opacities of dark archways from which the vampire can emerge and into which he can dissolve is both echoed and made new. Murnau's famously arresting use of shadows to visualize the vampire's defiling reach is reimagined when those shadows in this new version extend themselves in a 360-degree pan that evokes their vertiginous inescapability. And the shadow of the vampire's hand now extends across the entire city, repurposing the most memorable image from Murnau's Faust. But this new Nosferatu is even more clearly Ellen's story. If in Murnau's original the awfulness is coming for everyone and Ellen is its temporary focus, in Eggers it's coming for Ellen and everyone else is collateral damage. Both movies render the vampire as a grotesque form of desire that's both irresistibly powerful and catastrophically dangerous. And in both, the woman can only overcome that desire by indulging in it, and doing so will ensure her destruction and save everyone else. If you're a female filmgoer, at this point you're likely muttering, "What else is new?" Eggers' films have always featured emotional intensities that can seem overdone in their in-your-face aggressiveness, and a lot of what's dramatized in terms of the movie's unspeakable erotic bond falls into that category. Ellen's taut and trembling lust for the vampire is staged and restaged, and she has any number of fits in which she writhes in the mud or in bed and seems as possessed as Reagan in The Exorcist. She is even at one point tied to her bed like poor Reagan, and the comprehensive explicitness of her final consummation with the vampire is mitigated only by the occasional mercy of the night's shadows. The effect is to rub our faces in the self-destructive horror of the heroine's impulses and to shift that baleful sense of the erotic's dark power from a disturbing subtext to a more sensationalized foreground. The end result is a version that may achieve the most that a remake of a masterwork can. It generates respect for the appreciation and resourcefulness behind the attempt and reminds us of the rewards of revisiting the original. In what we might call our current remake culture, Marvel can keep cranking out new versions of Spider-Man's origin story, but the agenda there is to exploit an already existing audience and story arc. Masterpiece remakes offer something very different, speaking to us with surprising urgency and cogency across time. During the promotional run for the film, Eggers raised the question of why he sought to reimagine the classic. "Obviously, yes, I'm obsessed with Nosferatu, passionate about it, dorky about it, but why do it again?" Eggers said to the CBC. "If the female protagonist is the central protagonist, I have the opportunity for the story to be potentially more emotionally and psychologically complex instead of an adventure story about a real estate agent. Here we are in 2025 again, confronting with increasingly dire stakes the self-deluding toxicity of male narcissism, the corrosive effects of power, and the malevolence of late model capitalism. Eggers' version of the vampire, then, speaking to his moment, reminds us with a malignant satisfaction that he is an appetite and nothing more. And Ellen, speaking to hers, registers that understanding and then refuses to turn away from it. Masterpieces do what they can to educate us, and another reason we return to them and to other good remakes is that we keep demonstrating our need for more than one lesson. They exhilarate us about all the ways in which we can transcend our own limitations, and they call us to account for all the ways in which we can continue to refuse to do so. Without those possibilities our imaginations provide, we're locked into the tyranny of repeated mistakes. Remakes, in other words, may represent our attempt to put our compulsions to reiterate to more aspirational use. The writer Jim Shepherd has written 8 novels, including most recently Phase 6 and The Book of Aaron, which won the Penn New England Award for Fiction and the Clark Fiction Prize. He's an emeritus professor at Williams College. Now I'll read another Screenland, The L.A. Fire, Where Something Went Right. While some Angelenos cast around for someone to blame, a whole cooperative emergency response system whirled to life. It's an article by Ryan Francis Bradley. There's an arsonist here in L.A., Henry Winkler posted on X. It was 10:36 p.m. on Wednesday, January 8th. Almost as soon as the blaze in Pacific Palisades had broken out, the assignment of blame began. The president-elect was blaming the governor. A billionaire mall owner was blaming the mayor. Now, a full day into Los Angeles' burning, responsibility for the fires had been distilled to its purest form, the arsonist. No actual cause for the fires had been determined, but arson was simple. As we had to do now was find this person. All we had to do now was find this person and stop them. Just hours before Winkler's post, a little before 6 p.m., a new fire, the Sunset Fire, broke out on a steep hillside between Runyon and Nichols Canyons in the Hollywood Hills, a few blocks north of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevards, a famous slice of the Santa Monica Mountains that juts right into the thick of Los Angeles. The night before, across town in Altadena, embers from the Eaton Fire were carried by howling winds and ignited buildings as far as 3 miles away from the fire line. The Sunset Fire could easily have done much worse. It was burning a stone's throw from a swath of L.A. that is among the country's most dense, filled with apartment buildings, commercial blocks, major museums, and even L.A.'s most famous mall, The Grove, which reputedly has more visitors per year than Disneyland. But the Sunset Fire didn't burn the city down. Instead, less than 24 hours after it started, it had stopped. It had torched 43 acres of brush surrounded by homes, but it was fully contained and suppressed without destroying a single structure, not even a car. A day after 2 huge and ultimately cataclysmic burns erupted on opposite ends of the city, after a full 24-hour shift spent trying to firm up defense lines, firefighters not only suppressed the new burn in the Hollywood Hills, but were also combating 3 other major named fires, as well as smaller brush fires throughout the city. There's an app called Watch Duty that tracks wildfires and the response to them. it has over the past few weeks been installed on the phones of many, many Angelenos. Anyone who had paid for the members' version would have seen something remarkable that Wednesday. When the sunset fire broke out, there were already more than a dozen firefighting craft in the air by the Pacific Ocean, fighting the Palisades fire, and to the east around the San Gabriel Mountains, fighting the Eaton fire. The sky was quickly darkening. Visibility was worsening, and the winds were gusting harder and harder. A fixed-wing air attack platform flew overhead directing aerial traffic. It most likely spotted the smoke from sunset almost immediately. The pilot would have known that the window to make effective drops was shrinking fast. Suddenly, watch duty displayed many of those aircraft rerouting. They were heading towards sunset. These were aircraft from all over Southern California and beyond, piloted by crews that rushed in from across the western United States. There were trucks and crews from the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service, from Nevada, Utah, and Oregon, from well over 20 California cities and 7 counties. Orchestrating this kind of ad hoc, real-time response is a devilishly complex task, and pulling off such a quick pivot to suppress another new fire is a true feat of modern management. The system behind it is called NIMS, the National Incident Management System. It's what allowed so many different fire crews to make that quick adjustment and save a significant swath of Los Angeles. The system that led to NIMS was invented here in Southern California. In 1970, a series of fires raged throughout the area. This fire siege, as it came to be known, required agencies to fight a series of fires, a complex fire across the region's unique blend of wild and urban environments. But the agencies were unable to communicate well. They couldn't coordinate an effective response. The fires burned for 13 days, torching more than 500,000 acres, destroying at least 700 homes, and killing 16 people. 2 years later, Congress agreed to fund the firefighting resources of Southern California organized for potential emergencies project, known as FireScope, and the Forest Service began working with Southern California fire agencies to fix the fire problem. FireScope would grow into NIMS, carrying with it one of the fundamental findings of the whole project. In a fire siege situation, departments needed to pool resources and quickly. And to do that, they needed to set up mutual aid agreements. Yes, at the heart of a federal management system is mutual aid, a concept developed by the Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin. Mutual aid agreements are common, and not only among firefighters. They crop up across almost every agency and every level of government. They are so common that FEMA publishes an entire guide for mutual aid. The essential nature of these contracts isn't all that different from what Kropotkin identified. Groups that work together, that share and shift their resources toward those most in need, are more successful than groups that don't. Sharing like this is particularly vital in emergency situations because almost no one and no one department is fully prepared for an enormous crisis. As FEMA dryly puts it, most jurisdictions don't maintain sufficient resource levels to handle extreme events independently. The rapid shift of resources required to suppress the sunset fire is a perfect example of the sort of sharing Kropotkin envisioned, but its success creates an absence. It's seen mostly in things that didn't happen. We can't know how many homes or lives it saved. The sunset fire was put out quickly, and because it was put out quickly, it could be forgotten quickly. And yet the mutual aid agreements that rendered the sunset fire forgettable tell us infinitely more about how we are going to go on living here alongside fire and its aftermath than any assignment of blame, arson, or otherwise. Whom did we envision as the arsonist? Some leap to report on the homeless and previous fires that started in their encampments. Others were tempted by theories involving energy weapons, DEI practices, or DIDI. Those disgusted by tech-posted infographics about the amount of water necessary to run AI servers and our need for the fire to be personal, to be someone's fault, to be a thing someone did to us, we revealed any number of our own hypocrisies. Rick Caruso, the billionaire mall owner who quickly went on TV to blame Mayor Karen Bass, hired a private fire crew to protect his Brentwood home and other properties. But in hiring firefighters away from their own departments, he broke the very chain of mutual aid that ended up beating back the Sunset Fire, a fire that was prevented from ever threatening the Grove, one of Caruso's own malls. Blame is an easier, more visceral, and seemingly actionable emotion than grappling with the fact that monumental fire is a thing that happens and has been happening for millions of years throughout Southern California. I never really understood what it is to live in a place that is predestined to burn until recently, when I became a gardener and got into propagating native seeds. To germinate the seeds of certain lupines, it helps to put them to fire, that is, to heat them up, even under a flame. This is because the plants have evolved to follow fire. Lupines have lived in California some 4.6 million years, humans as little as 15,000. They have figured out how to use fire's heat as a signal, sprouting aggressively in its wake. For us, the fire is similarly revealing. The fire is a mirror. It lays bare our best and our worst, our need for one another. And I'll close today with Judge John Hodgman on the taxonomy of shorts. Are they pants? And if so, what would that imply? David writes, "My wife says shorts are not pants. I say shorts are pants. Short pants, but pants. I seek an order preventing her from saying or implying that I'm not wearing pants when I'm wearing shorts." And the judge writes, "I'm a fake judge, not a fake detective. But based on your email signature, I know you're a philosophy professor in Boulder, Colorado. And so I can deduce two things. One, that you enjoy devising thought experiments like this to amuse yourself and perhaps annoy your wife as an added bonus. And two, you only own shorts anyway. In any case, I think it's fair to say that shorts are a category of pants, so you're not completely wrong. But it sounds to me as if you're trying to get away with wearing cargo shorts to a funeral or something. And while I'm sure there are many people in Boulder who would back you, your wife doesn't, and neither do I. Use precise language. And if you're at a formal event, cover those calves, Professor Hot Pants." Thanks for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.